So one of the issues that I've had for a very long time, especially as I've gotten older, is finding a good pair of jeans. When I was young, this wasn't a problem for me, but now that comfort's the number one factor that I look for, I just hadn't found anything that worked as something I could wear all day, every day, until now. Men, if you hate khakis like I do, your time has come. The Perfect Jean was created by a conglomerate of mostly imperfect men and a couple of extra perfect ladies who set out on a mission to find a jean that we can wear no matter what we're doing. Whether you're lounging on the couch, working outside, salsa dancing, doing yoga poses, or dunking a basketball, this is a pair of jeans that is built for your life. I picked up a pair skeptical at first because I've been let down so many times before, but I've got to tell you, these jeans slip on like your favorite pair of sweatpants. You know the ones. Once I had my pair, I reached out to the team at Perfect Jean and asked them if I could run an ad on my show. And they were kind enough to offer you, yes, you listening right now, a special 25% off discount code that you can use when you pick up your very own pair. Don't be like me and pay full price. Take advantage and pick up the best pair of jeans you've ever worn right now. Head to theperfectjean.nyc and enter the discount code 25 for friends at checkout to get 25% off your very own pair of Perfect Jeans. Lara, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I actually started watching your show. I was looking around for stuff like on lesser known true crime cases, probably, mm-hmm. I don't know, a while back. And then of course I kind of stumbled across your YouTube channel and started going back and listening and watching all the vlogs you put out, and sort of here we are. I want to start because I've learned a lot from sort of watching what you've been doing, but I want to start by asking about like the structure of the show, because I always do this every time we have people that do YouTube or podcasters on or whatever. Like I always ask them this question to kind of kick it off. The structure of the show, like, you know, how you do it, how you record it and everything, like, mm-hmm. can you talk about sort of how you develop that? Because it's a pretty nice, clean structure that you have now.
Yeah, so I started on an investigative discovery show last year. And with those, while they're not, I don't want to say disrespectful, like, mm-hmm. they're a bit more comedic with how they present the cases.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the structure of what they were doing. So the back and forth between the interviews and the stock footage and the dramatizations and the actual photos and all of that. So I kind of got inspired.
Yeah.
For my own YouTube channel to do that, because I have a background in media production. So I definitely had all of the tools at my disposal to be able to make as high of quality content as I could. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be best to kind of bring something a little different to the table than it just being, you know, a 20-minute video of just my face on the screen. So
yeah.
So I have my intro, I do the different graphics to separate the segments, and then I have stock footage just to give it a break so you're not staring at me the entire time and your vision is just going different places. So it's more intriguing that way, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting because, and you can tell, and of course we'll have a link to the YouTube channel in the show notes for the episode tonight, but you can tell, you know, that you've got the media background, because the show is really nicely done. It's really professionally put together. I think, you know, there's so many, like you mentioned, there's so many YouTube channels out there that, you know, it's great content and everything, but
yeah.
what you sort of do is a little, it's visually stunning sort of compared to a lot of the other ones, because it's a very different kind of aesthetic, which
you.
I really
yeah.
like. Yeah. It keeps the viewer engaged. What I wanted to ask you about is because we have a lot of people out here that'll be listening to this tonight, this episode tonight, and they'll be basically you know, they want to get into what you're doing. They're sort of, they don't know how to do it. They see it online. I mean, it always seems easy at first when you watch it online. Oh, I could do that. But I mean, you get into it, you get in over your head really quickly. Can you sort of give folks a rundown that are listening that might really want to kind of do what you're doing now? Just kind of give them an inside look of kind of what you do. You mentioned the stock footage. Like, how do you attain that? How do you shoot some of this stuff? It's pretty remarkable.
Sure. So, like I said, I have my background in media production, which I did a 2-year college program. So I learned all about composition and editing and audio and all of that. So I do have that background, which I guess gives me a little bit of a step up compared to just the average person.
Yeah.
But for anybody that's wanting to do it, you know, you don't need the fancy cameras and all of that to make a successful YouTube channel. Certainly there are many people out there that have a lot of success just making videos off of their iPhone. But what I do is I'm using my Canon T3i with a wide lens for that, for my true crime videos, just because, you know, it's a high quality camera that we have. I know it's a little bit outdated, but it is there for me to use. So I use that. I use a lav mic hooked up to a Tascam, just because I feel like audio is so important. If that is a tip I'm going to give to someone, like, that would be the number one.
Absolutely.
Audio is, you could have the most beautiful looking video, but if your audio quality is crap, then it brings down the value, in my opinion.
Yeah, 100%. A woman after my own heart. I'm like that with film. I would almost rather watch a movie on just like a really straightforward subpar screen and have great audio than the other way around, because it's just you miss so much when you have subpar audio. So I
totally
agree 100%. Yeah.
And after I record my audio, I bring it into Adobe Audition and I mess around with the levels and the equalization and all of that just to bring it up a little bit, because it does tend to record a bit flat. So I'm really trying to bring in all of my skill sets together in order to create the best content that I can. But in addition to all of that, I'm using 2 LED lights. I still have some work to do with lighting. Lighting is definitely not my strong suit, but trying my best with that. And I do my best to have a compelling background. I live in a small apartment, so there's only so much I can do with that.
No, that's great. I think that's going to be helpful for people that are listening that are going to be, you know, wanting to get into, you know, to what you do. What's interesting about, you know, you and listening to kind of you talk just now, you're talking about sort of like, you know, areas you want to improve on and things like that, and things you think you sort of might lack in. But I mean, I want to ask you, like, how important is that in your eyes? Because people just sort of like, you know, sometimes they get real down on themselves, and there's self-doubt and there's things like that. And there's definitely a question I want to get into something you mentioned on Twitter a while back, which I think is very raw and honest that you kind of talk about on Twitter. But how do you deal with just sort of constantly improving the product, which is what you're putting out there?
I think it's just a matter of doing it over and over again. And it's a matter of trial and error.
Yeah.
When I made YouTube videos, like, way back in the day for fun, I was just using natural lighting and it looked fine, but you know, you only could record during certain hours and you had to record if it was an overcast day, because if you didn't, then the sun would be changing, going behind clouds, and it would just wreck your whole video look.
Yeah.
But I find that now, with doing the different videos, and the more that I do, the better I become and the more that I learn. I had to go and get a second light because I needed that separation between, you know, the wall and myself. And I feel like it's a matter of trial and error. And the more you do it, the more you'll learn and the more you'll improve. And if you keep going at it, you're only going to get better.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I do want to talk about your topic, which is true crime. I mean, we've had so many true crime podcasters on the show we've recorded with. I mean, it's it's such a huge sort of like area now. It's really dominated. You mentioned Investigation Discovery earlier. Mm-hmm. It's just all over the place. And there's so many vlogs out there. It's one of the more covered areas. But I want to ask you to do is sort of talk about what it takes to sort of make your show stand out from the rest in terms of sort of creating something that's attractive to potential new viewers, keeping the existing viewers. I mean, the aesthetic is there, the visualization is there, but is that something you constantly kind of discuss and talk about?
Totally. I spend so much time trying to up my YouTube quality. I mess with the different kinds of backgrounds and I use different lenses sometimes to see if one is better than the other. But in terms of the content itself, I'm always trying to improve on how I research my cases, the different kinds of sources that I use. Sometimes there are podcasts that give you a lot of information. Sometimes there are documentaries on it. Sometimes you only have, you know, the internet research to look at. So I find that dependent on the different cases, especially if they are lesser known, you have to do so much more digging into the research, and you're essentially creating something from nothing. You know, you're creating something from all of these different kinds of sources.
What I love about what you do is you cover a lot of smaller, lesser known cases, and you just touched on it right now. Do you think it's important, and I probably know the answer to this, but do you think it's important for true crime shows to sort of cover smaller cases? Like, how important is that for, instead of just covering the less, you know, the bigger cases that everybody knows, you know, the local stuff, the smaller stuff that, you know, these are families involved in this. I mean, how important is that to you?
It's completely important. My favorite kind of cases, if favorite is a word that you can use to describe it, are the lesser known cases, because yes, you know, the Madeline McCann case has had numerous people covering it, and that's wonderful. But there are so many, especially missing persons cases, that are out there that aren't being covered or are being covered not in the same amount of volume as these other huge cases. And one of my absolute favorite cases that I've covered was the disappearance of Anne Elizabeth Hagen.
Yeah.
She was a Norwegian woman who had gotten abducted from her house one morning, and it was just horrifying for me to see. And I actually came upon this on Reddit. I follow a subreddit called Unresolved Mysteries, and this had come up from somebody who was from Norway. And I was reading through their Reddit post, and I was like, how is nobody else talking about this? And I was searching on YouTube, and there were pretty much no English speaking people who were bringing light to this case. There were a few people who were doing these cases in who were from Norway, who were speaking in Norwegian. And I was like, why don't I make a video about this? And while I know I certainly don't have a huge number of subscribers, at least if somebody is going to search that case, then I can give them the information on it and bring awareness to this case as an English-speaking person.
Yeah.
So it involved me going through all of these Norwegian articles and using Google Translate to translate the pages. And I don't know if you've ever tried to translate something that was from a different language, but it never translates properly. So it was having to decipher all of these English sentences that didn't make a ton of sense sometimes. So I was kind of worried that some of the information wouldn't come across correctly, but I think I did a really good job in bringing that case to light, and I'm just happy that I was able to come across that case and be able to give it a place on YouTube where other people just haven't come across that, because you know, who from Canada or the US is reading the Norwegian missing persons cases in the news, you know? So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I mean, with true crime, because it's such a big sort of thing now. I mean, it's such a flooded market now. It's terrible to look at it that way, but it like, you know, you're trying to come out with something that's, you're trying to cover cases, I think, you know, that have never been covered before because, you know, these people, there's families involved, there's, you know, spouses, children, you know, people that are missing, people that have gotten terrible things done to them.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think for true crime, I think the name of the game is to try to tell fresh stories, new stories. It's unfortunate that it's happening. Obviously it's not something I think we'd all sort of want to run out of true crime stories one day because we don't want to see it happen. But if you're going to do true crime, the more awareness you can get out about cases that maybe haven't been covered, I think the better off you're going to be and the bigger your channel is going
to
get.
I know for me, for doing true crime cases, I really love to have, I don't know, a personal connection to the case.
Yeah.
That's how I select the ones that I want to do. For example, there was the Carrie Ann Brown case that happened in the 80s, and it actually took place, you know, 7 hours away from me in the same province.
Wow.
And for me to come across, you know, the biggest unsolved case in Manitoba, and I'd never heard about this before, was crazy. And as I was reading into the information, I knew the places that they were talking about when they made reference to Winnipeg, which is where I live. You know, obviously I knew what they were talking about, and you just don't hear that. Like, I'm not from New York or Chicago or places where things tend to happen a lot, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so with doing research for that case, it hit so close to home, literally, because it's so close to where I live, and to learn about all of this gruesome information and how this real family that I could potentially come across on the street one day, it really humbles you and makes you feel so honored to be able to bring awareness to this person's case, because not a lot of people have talked about her case either. And for somebody actually being from the area, bringing light to this case was just so monumental for me. And it made it so much more personal and emotional for me to deliver this case.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to look at it. And I think it's, people need to hear that. True crime, you know, as everybody knows, it's really popular. What do you think it is about that genre in particular that it just attracts so much attention? I mean, the Aaron Hernandez documentary, Making a Murder, I mean, it's big business. What do you think it is about that genre in particular that just, why do we care so much? Why is it so attractive to people just in general, you think?
I think people just love the mystery. Mm. I think people are very interested in the mystery elements that happen with especially unsolved mysteries and disappearance cases. And as horrible as it is, these are entertaining to look at. And it's a weird line to walk doing true crime videos, because on one hand, you look at these cases as a potential source of entertainment for people, and that goes the same for the people who are watching them.
Sure.
And for people like me who are making these videos, at some point there comes a sort of distance away from the cases.
Yeah.
Like you're researching these cases, you're looking all over all of these horrific details, and you tend to distance yourself from it. And because that's really the only way that you can make these videos without crying the entire way through it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, do you find that that's a good point you make about distancing yourself from it? Because you're looking at it like, you know, almost like a puzzle, right? So you're kind of like, you're looking at this whole thing. Do you think that helps? I mean, there's a lot of people like, you know, I listen to, you know, the Up and Vanish podcast of Payne Lindsay, and he, you know, he breaks that case with Tara Grinstead. He breaks this case open to this 10-year-old cold case during the actual, you know, nobody had heard anything for 10 years about this missing woman. And all of a sudden he starts kind of, you know, pushing on people and kind of, you know, pressuring and investigating and kind of looking at it in a whole new light. And he breaks the case wide open. sort of just out of the blue, and it's like live covered on the podcast, and it's pretty remarkable. Like, but he's looking at it sort of with a fresh set of eyes. He's looking at it. I mean, there's obviously empathy there. I mean, we're all human beings, but I mean, do you find that you sort of have to look at it almost like a puzzle? You almost have to look at it. You almost have to have like a detached sort of POV on it when you're looking at stuff like this in order to sort of get through it and to sort of look at it objectively.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, the details in any sort of disappearance or murder, whatever, are often very horrific or nightmarish, you know? So I think after you get over the initial shock, if you are just starting to get into doing true crime videos, obviously researching that type of information is going to be very unsettling. It's going to make you very unhappy.
Yeah.
But I believe there does come a time where you start looking at these cases as another thing to research.
Yeah.
I would think that it, not to compare myself to like detectives or any of the, amazing people out there, but you look at it through kind of the same lens as they do, because you're here to present this story in a respectful way. You're here to bring awareness to this case, and people want to watch something informative. They want to watch something that is being given respectfully and entertain, like it's entertainment in a sense. So
yeah, I get it. Yeah, it's a fine line.
Exactly. So I think there does come a sense of detachment, and it's obviously you always feel that empathy for the cases, but in order to spend the hours that it takes to research these cases, you definitely do have to learn to put your feelings aside so that you can look for all of the missing pieces and try to make connections where perhaps other people haven't before. And like you said, bring a fresh new set of eyes to the case. There's tons of people on the internet, on Reddit and on forums and YouTube comments, where people are starting to become like internet sleuths in a sense. And I know for sure with the Ricky McCormick case, if you're unaware with that one, it was about this man who had been murdered, and in his pocket were a series of cryptic letters. And the FBI had been trying to decode what these letters meant for, I think it was 12 years.
Wow.
And then with this FBI department, it usually takes them like an hour to decipher your normal coded message. But for this one, they just couldn't figure it out. They handed it off to a number of different companies and people. And eventually, like 12 years later, they were like, hey, we can't figure this out, and released these messages to the public to help gain a new perspective on it. Perhaps somebody out there on the internet is going to be able to figure out what these messages could mean and potentially break this case wide open, help figure out what actually happened to this person who died so tragically.
Wow. Yeah, that's, and you're seeing a lot more of that now with, with the explosion of social media. You see police departments that are reaching out to the public, reaching out to social media actually for assistance in solving cases. Somebody's seen this person. Somebody last saw this person. It's pretty remarkable. I mean, social media has really changed the game when it comes to true crime and helping solve cases. And I think that's one of the benefits of social media. There's a lot of drawbacks, but that's one of the benefits, I think.
Yeah. And the police are doing such an amazing job trying to incorporate social media into their day-to-day activities. When I was in college, or in university rather, I went to college and then I went to university. I was doing an honors practicum course for my criminology, and my report that I had to do research on was to look at the response of the RCMP, their usage of social media, and how the public and how the police force themselves were perceiving it, because it was a separate division that was doing the social media. And so that helped to pique my interest in getting into this sort of true crime anyway. And I know for the RCMP Manitoba social media page, going back to the Carrie Brown case, a few years back, they utilized social media to help kind of get the word out about her case because it had been like 30 years and still no headway had been found as to who had done this to this young girl. And so what they were doing was they were going on Twitter and they were making a series of tweets in her voice. So they were writing as her, and they were giving different tweets, different descriptions of her final day going up to the night where she went to this party where she ultimately disappeared and was later found horrifically beaten dead in the woods. And they were describing how this could have potentially happened to her, giving a lot of not gruesome description, but enough to make you feel very unsettled. Yeah. And I think you never hear really about people doing that, especially a police force. So I think to be able to use social media as a means to bring the public into this, to give the public the information in order to keep their eyes out or to think differently about the things that they're seeing in their day-to-day life that could potentially help solve cases or just bring new information, new tips in.
Yeah, that's really innovative and very heavy. And
yeah,
that's incredible. I mean, so, yeah, social media, God bless Twitter in a lot of ways, not every way, but a lot of ways.
Yes.
It's pretty remarkable. Now we were talking about this before we started recording, but you just put out, a trailer for a documentary you'd worked on, and then you went ahead and dropped the documentary itself. Can you tell everybody it's the newest video. Can you tell everybody about sort of this particular story? This is really pretty crazy.
Sure. So I actually made this documentary about 4 or 5 years ago, and I had just replied to something on Twitter asking about like 3 facts about you. And I was trying to figure out something that people didn't already know, because I'm very open on Twitter. I just say whatever I want to on there. And so I mentioned that I had produced a fully funded documentary for a production company, and a few people had DM'd me asking if they could see this documentary. And I was originally going to just put it up unlisted for people who wanted to watch it.
Yeah.
And I after asking people if they wanted me to just make it public, I decided to upload it and put it out there. And the documentary is about the history of a sanatorium that was in my hometown of Ninette, Manitoba. Hmm. And the way that I had come across this originally was back in college, we had the opportunity to do a pitch fest, was what it was called. So the producers from MTS TV would come down from Winnipeg, and there were a couple others there too. I don't remember who they were, but they worked for other companies as well. And they would be giving a bunch of money as a budget sort of, to pick a series of documentaries that people in my class would come up with. And then we'd split off into groups and make them all together kind of thing. And I was trying to figure out something to do. It had to be local for the most part. It had to be somewhere in the province, because that was the kind of content that this production company was interested in putting out and funding.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out something to do, and I realized that there is this huge abandoned sanatorium just sitting in the hills in my hometown that I have been staring at for the 19 years that I'd lived there. And I was like, I wonder if there was more of a history there, because people referred to it as the sanatorium, but I didn't know what that meant. And my mom used to work there after the sanatorium had closed and had become a training center for intellectually disabled adults. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of that place being used. And then it closed and is essentially sitting there abandoned now, very sadly. So I started looking into the history of this, and I discovered that it was used as a tuberculosis center back in the early 1900s. So people who were afflicted with tuberculosis would go to this sanatorium, and they would be treated with rest and fresh air, because that was the prescribed treatment for it at that time, because there was no actual treatment for it. I believe it's like a vaccine or something now to treat tuberculosis. So that was how they treated it back then. And I was so interested in this. This was so compelling. I couldn't believe that something with so much history was sitting right in my backyard, essentially, and I had no idea about it. And I was pretty sure that if I asked anybody else in town, they would have pretty much no idea about it either. So I started doing a ton of research on the history of this sanatorium. There wasn't a ton of information out there because this is, it's Manitoba, it's the province that nobody in Canada really cares about. So I had some issues figuring out a lot of research about it because there just wasn't a lot out there and I didn't know where to start. I didn't know who to talk to about it. I had no idea. And my mom, I was asking her and she'd worked there, you know, years after it had become something else. So she had no idea. And either way, I went and pitched this idea to the broadcasters. And yeah, it didn't get picked at that time because I didn't have any access to the building. I didn't have anybody to interview that was of prominence. And so I kind of just left it on the table, but they were very interested in it and told me to come back and pitch it to them later when I was out of school and after I had done a bit more information into it. Yeah. So fast forward a few years and I emailed them. I was like, hey, are you guys still interested in this? And at this time, I had kind of taken it upon myself to contact people at, I forget what it's called, but it was some sort of museum archives thing in a city nearby. And I had gotten a contact from him at the University of Manitoba here. So I at least had a starting point. My mom had figured out somebody who had actually worked at the sanatorium as a nurse back in the day. So I had two people at this time. And so I went to the producers and I was like, here, like, I have all of this information. I have these interviews. I'm going to work on getting access to the building. And they were completely down for it. So I was given a budget and left to my own devices to go and make this documentary. And after a lot of work, a lot of digging, I was able to locate the owner of the sanatorium who was living in Saskatchewan, which is a whole other province over. I had to get access from her, which I had to coordinate with somebody in town who had the keys to the building, which I then had to coordinate with somebody else who would let us into the building. And it was a whole situation, but it was amazing. We got interviews done with a U of M professor who had visited the sanatorium, because the thing is that it's not open to the public. You are not even supposed to be stepping foot onto these grounds because it's dangerous. These buildings are abandoned. So many of them have been torn down and you're not supposed to step foot onto this property and much less be able to go inside. Yeah. And so I did the interview with the professor who had gone there. He was also a member of the Historical Society of Manitoba. So I was able to get more information that way. I had interviewed the former nurse that had worked there, which gave a whole new amazing perspective to that because she had actually been there.
Wow. When did the sanatorium close? Like, how long had it been abandoned?
I believe it closed down in like the 70s. It closed down after a while and then it reopened in the early 2000s. So it sat vacant for around 30 years, if I remember correctly, because around the time that it closed, I guess the treatment of tuberculosis had been discovered. So there were less and less people coming to the sanatorium and there was no need for it to be operational anymore.
Mm-hmm. Wow. God, what a story. We'll definitely have a link to that for sure in the show notes so people can check it out. It's about 22 minutes long. I'm looking forward to watching. I got a chance to see the sizzle and it's really, really looks good.
Thank you. I'm very proud of it. I'm so happy that I was able to bring about this moment of history that I personally think not a lot of people, especially in my hometown, were aware of. So to bring that to a wider audience as well was really, really great for me to be able to do. It helped me to expand my skill set in making documentaries. I know that this documentary is of me being just fresh out of college, and there are certainly mistakes and errors in that, which looking back now, I'm so critical of myself. So they probably are fine upon the surface for anybody else watching it. But it was, it's an amazing experience to be able to have the opportunity to have a funded documentary to create.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah,
I bet. That's pretty remarkable. Now, there's one thing. If you scroll down on your actual YouTube page, you see that you also have some covers on there. You actually sing as well, which is pretty cool. I came across that as well. Talk about that. I mean, that's something that's another way you're sort of putting yourself out there.
Yeah. Music has pretty much been the air that I breathe since I was very young. I put out the covers on YouTube originally because that was just what I felt like doing at that time. That was the type of content that I felt inspired to make at the time. And I switched to true crime eventually because I wasn't getting enough of a challenge doing song covers, even though I obviously still love doing music. But the way I got into it was I used to sing all the time. When I was very young, I used to stand in front of the big speaker in our living room and sing along to Shania Twain. And I was counting down the years until I turned 16 so I could audition for Canadian Idol. Unfortunately, it got canceled the year before I turned 16, which was horrible. But honestly, around the age of 10, I started writing my own lyrics. My dad plays the guitar, so he taught me the basics of that. And while they weren't amazing songs, obviously at the age of 10, it did help me like improve, and writing songs was something that I continuously turned to, especially throughout grade 7 to 12, because I'd switched schools in grade 7 and had been very bullied by my peers because I was into different things. People didn't want to be, you know, famous singers where I'm from. I'm from a very small town. And if you do something different, people tend to look at you differently for that. And they didn't understand it. And I would sit there on the bus ride home and write lyrics about what I'd been experiencing in school. And it was just a way that I could express my feelings and look at a situation from a different perspective. And throughout my high school experience, due to bullying, I wouldn't audition for solos in my choral class or for parts in the play because I thought if I did, I would get made fun of and I didn't need any more like hate than I already got. So a time that really stuck out to me was when I was doing vocal testing in grade 10 or 11, and my choral teacher it was a one-on-one thing. It would be you, the choral teacher, and you would be doing like pitch testing and you'd be singing parts of the songs that we'd done that year. And I was singing my piece, and after I was finished, my choral teacher was like, "Oh my goodness, I had no idea you had such an amazing voice. Why have you not tried out for solos? We're going to have to get you to try out for solos." And it made my heart drop because that was what I'd wanted to do so badly, but I was so worried about what the other kids would think, which is awful to put on yourself as a kid. So basically I was only singing and writing music in private, and I would do all of this creative stuff and nobody would ever know about it. And at one point I was taking other singers' instrumentals and I was singing my own songs over top of them. And just creating something like really different but really weird. And it helped me, you know, with melody creation and staying on pitch. And a few years later, when I was 20 or so, I came across an app called Smule, which is essentially a karaoke app. And I amassed I'm at almost 10,000 followers on there.
Wow.
And yeah, and I completely credit this app to being how I came into my voice, how I developed a richer tone, how I learned to belt, and because I've never gotten singing lessons before, and this helped me to come into my voice and understand what I could bring to the table musically. So then I started doing song covers on YouTube, and I have professional audio equipment here. So sometimes I'll record covers just to put on SoundCloud or whatever. And I recently bought this program that I'm planning on releasing my own original music, hopefully by the end of the year. If I achieve nothing else in my life, if I can release my own original music, even if it goes nowhere, on the internet, whatever, the fact that I have released music is just going to be one of the best things that I will have ever done.
That sounds amazing. Well, I love the covers. Lose You to Love Me is great, especially.
Thank you. That's
a great cover. I want to ask you about, you touched on sort of, you know, the music and kind of what you want to do hopefully with that. I know you actually reached out on Twitter a while back and asked people to kind of give you some ideas of, you know, what they want to see you cover. I think I mentioned ASMR, I think, specifically, because I'm a huge ASMR freak. Like I love, that's, my wife introduced me to that. My wife doesn't even like it, but she's like, oh, I think you might like this. And now my son, I love it. It works. I mean, for me, it works. You know what I mean? It's like whatever works for anxiety and for, you know, just falling asleep and things like that. So are you planning on doing any ASMR? Anything else you want to do? What are you going to experiment with?
I have attempted to do ASMR on my channel before in the past. I'm not great at it. I don't have the particular microphone that you need to be able to do it, to pick up the, I think it's like the lower frequencies.
Yeah.
I tried to do a semi-ASMR reading of a short story that I did. So I just recorded that and put stock music or stock photos over top of it with some music underneath, but it's definitely not me like whispering it. I did try doing some softer singing as well in an ASMR-ish style, but I don't know. I think I sound really dumb when I try to whisper, because I have a tendency to not be able to pronounce my S's very well all the time. And I feel like if I tried to record ASMR, I would sound awful. I don't even really listen to it. I understand the benefits
that it
gives to people, but if I try listening to it, it sets my teeth on edge. Like I can't sit there and listen to it at all. Yeah. But I definitely understand and appreciate the draw that it has to people. But in terms of what else I want to do with my YouTube channel, definitely want to keep doing true crime and music and all of that. I want to do a sort of docu-series later on in the year, just kind of incorporating more of that documentary style that I have a background in. So I might be documenting either my like music path, or I'll be doing kind of like talking about mental health and things like that. I do want to start talking more about mental health on my channel. I've done a little bit of it recently, but I really want to make it something that is common on my channel, because I think it's so important to continue the conversation surrounding mental health and bringing awareness to anxiety, depression, and all of that, and destigmatizing it. And I feel like the only way that people can do that is by sharing their stories. So I definitely want to contribute to the conversation as best as I can, because I certainly have had my fair share of mental health issues over the years. So I for sure want to make some videos about that. And I don't know, I want to get out more. I want to do more vlogs and fun things. I love making just those personal vlogs that are so silly and really help to diversify my content. They help to add some personality to it, because when you're doing true crime, you can't be joking and laughing about everything, which is my personality. And, you know, you have to come across very respectfully and, you know, but I really love having vlogs, because they're a timestamp of a moment and it's a memory of something that you're doing, like buying a new car or going home for Christmas. Like, I've never really had things like that filmed before. You can have pictures, but to have a edited video is just something so different. And I know people love to watch my vlogs, but for me, like, it's a memory for me to have, a physical memory. And I'm going to Vegas in April, so I'm going to be vlogging that. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to my YouTube. I feel like it's going to be my year, and as I continue going, I'm just going to come up with more and more ideas. So I don't really know what's in store, but I feel like it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, that sounds great to me. Now, the last thing I want to ask you tonight before we, as we sort of wrap up here, the conversation is, and you've touched on it a little bit a couple times throughout the conversation, but I want to get into it sort of in the final question is, obviously when you put yourself out there, whether it's YouTube, you know, I mean, I've certainly gone through my fair share of this as well with what I've been doing. There's a lot of haters that come out of the woodwork. There's a lot of trolls. There's a lot of people that just don't, you know, they just have nothing good to say. So they focus on the negative. Mm-hmm. You're very open and raw and honest about it. That's sort of one of the things I really admire about, like, especially on Twitter. Like, you know, you talk about, you know, fears, and you talk about anxieties, you talk about things like that. It's not something that it's hidden. I want to ask you to sort of talk about that. And it sort of kind of goes full circle to the first couple of questions I asked you, not about people that want to do what you do and maybe just are afraid to take that first step.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? What are some of the practices you put in? I mean, how do you kind of coach yourself through that? Can you walk us through that?
Sure. So the thing about hate comments is I honestly cannot fathom why someone would leave one in the first place. And like, I'm not talking about constructive criticism. Like, if someone thinks my audio is bad, or if I'm acting a certain way that's negative, or if I say an incorrect fact, like, yes, please let me know. But for those who hate simply for the sake of hating and who leave nothing for you to take away except for hurt, I feel so sorry for those people. And it's taken me a long time to get to that place where when somebody would comment negatively on my YouTube channel, you know, it would hurt me to my core and I would take it so personally. But I think, especially in true crime, people get incredibly hateful. And I don't understand why, if someone doesn't like my video, why don't you just click off and go watch something else? Like, why does your parting message have to be one of hate? If you are so offended by how I researched my video or how I presented my video or whatever it was that bothered you, then, you know, you are under no obligation to continue watching me. And leaving a hate-filled comment with no added value on how I can improve just shows me that you are a sad, sorry person who has nothing better to do than tear people down to make yourself feel better. Yeah. And I think that, like, that's just what you have to tell yourself. You just have to keep doing you. And if you know that you are doing as much as you can to come across authentically and sincerely, then that's all you can do. People are going to hate regardless. It's the internet. And I think, as somebody who has experienced bullying in the past and has had many awful things said about me, you tend to get a little bit of a wall up for that. You get a bit more thick skin, but obviously on something that you are creating that you're so proud of, for somebody to leave such a hurtful comment, it just makes you feel awful. Yeah. And when people come at me for my true crime videos or my song covers, it can definitely hurt because I'm human. I'm definitely not perfect. I will make mistakes, but I'm always learning and trying to improve. And here people are spewing hate when they could be contributing to the conversation themselves. If they hate my videos so much or somebody else's video, then they can go make their own video.
Sure.
I think, for me, I need to learn to stop responding to people and giving them my energy and trying to explain myself and my character and the steps that I'm taking to be better, because at the end of the day, they don't care. They're they're looking for a response from you. They just want to hate to hate, and it's their reflection that they have to look at in the mirror. And I truly believe that kindness and compassion are so much more abundant, and I try to focus more on that and the love that I receive on my videos than the people who are there simply to be jerks.
Absolutely. Focus on the love, not the hate. That's very, very powerful. Okay. Well, before we get out of here, please plug the YouTube channel, SoundCloud, Twitter, whatever you like to do. Let's get that out there.
Yes, my YouTube channel is youtube.com/LaraPretty. I have a SoundCloud that's linked there. I'm not sure what the extension is on that. My Twitter is at Blue Lily Bay, and my Instagram is LaraPretty with an X at the end.
All right. This is it really is a hidden gem. If you've been sort of inspired by the conversation we've had tonight, if you're curious about it, check out her YouTube page. It'll be linked in the show notes tonight. You know, hit the subscribe button. It's really great. You're only a couple subscribers away from the 300 mark. I think you're going to do well. I think you're right. 2020 is going to be your year. This has been an absolute pleasure. Lara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so amazing talking to you.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle @MeMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @MeAndMyFriendsPod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. This episode of the podcast featured the original song, I Hope You Like Me, by producer Redman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.